Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. You want to have some fun?
Yeah, we want to have fun.
Okay, are you ready? Sing along now.
My name is Stanley Bookman, and I come from the world of ink. I live in a town called Storyville that's closer than you think. Just hop online and you will find my online world of fun. There's stories, poems, and features on everything under the sun. Just type in Stories for Children Magazine at .org to the end. Come join me in reading adventures, we're sure to become good friends. So come to the world of ink with me, we'll share a story or two. We'll go all over the world, you'll see, we'll have fun the whole day through.
Follow me to the world of ink.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Stories for Children show. This is your host, V.S. Grenier. Irene Roth was unable to make the show today, so we hope that she is doing well. She had some family issues that came up, so she will be in our thoughts throughout the week. We have a very special guest with us today on July 23rd, 2012, that I'm excited to share with you. I have not read the book, so this is actually going to be a little bit of a different show since I haven't had a chance to read the book, but I have been to the website, have been following some of the different promotions that have been going on from guest posts to interviews that our guest has been doing. So I'd like to welcome to our show Dominic Domingo. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm doing very well. How are you?
And just so our listeners know, it is 2 p.m. Eastern time, 11 a.m. Pacific time. So we do our show kind of in the afternoon, morning, you know, late morning type time. So everybody knows. And there are links on our show page to Dominic's site. Now, you just recently released a book, The Nameless Prince, that's a young adult novel, but you actually have a background in art and illustration, which I didn't realize. I mean, I knew that, but I didn't realize that you've actually done some stuff on Disney films.
Well, yeah, that was the bulk of my career, actually. I spent 10 years with Disney Feature Animation, so that's the bulk of my career. I started there directly after graduating Art Center, and spent 10 years there in Pocahontas, Hunchback, Tarzan, and then two Fantasia segments.
Wow, that is really, really impressive. I used to work, and I know we talked a little bit about the show, that I'm from the Southern California area, which is where you're at.
Right.
And I actually used to work for Fredericks of Hollywood, so I drove right through Studios. So I drove right through Studio City instead of taking the 10 into work from the foothills. Out there, I'd get off and take the side streets through Studio City and pass through Universal and
Disney. Is Fredericks on Ventura Boulevard or
on Hollywood? On Hollywood, on the Strip. It was on Hollywood Boulevard, the main corporate offices. I was a buyer, yeah, it's actually the store's still there, but the corporate offices have moved. But they used to be right above the Hollywood Strip store. Jamie Lee Curtis actually got her star right outside the door that went into the corporate offices where the buyers went through. And that was really fun. No, she actually came into our building. We got to meet our pictures with her. It's great. But, yeah, so I used to go right through there. So I know quite a few of I don't talk to them now because it's been quite a few years, but I used to back then, knew quite a lot of the, some of the Disney staff. I knew a couple of the people who did voices, like I met the guy, I can't think of his name now, but who had replaced the original voice of Tigger. I knew a couple of the Warner Brother artists, so it's actually kind of fun talking to you. And my husband has a friend whose brother actually used to work for Disney. I don't know his name, so I can't ask if you know him, but he actually had done some animation for Disney as well. So it's kind of fun having you here because I know that area.
Well, I'm sure
we
definitely
area.
Have mutual friends. I was there for 10 years, and it actually went from 500 to over 4,000 people in the animation division alone. So, but ironically, I do know, by name or face pretty much all of them. So I think it's hard in the L.A. area. It's almost impossible not to know somebody from Disney. But just as a side note, regarding the voices, my friend Andreas, who's arguably one of the top animators in the world, he does all the villains, like Jafar, Triton, Gaston. Anyway, he's the one guy who's actually still in touch with a lot of the voiceover artists, anyone who's still alive, basically. He's sort of the hub. You know, the Animation Research Library doesn't necessarily hold it all together, but Andreas has a Christmas party every year, and I think it was last year, you know, the writer, I don't remember their names, but the two writers that wrote everything from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang to It's a Small World After All, they sat down at the piano and played those songs. They played It's a Small World the way it was intended. It's actually much slower and more melodic. And anyway, the voice of Mowgli was there, and it's very nostalgic.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that is just amazing. You know, and I'm sure working there and being around all of that talent, I mean, I know when I go to writing conferences, workshops, when I actually teach at my local college here at Dixie State, in their continuing literature department, the writing workshops to kind of help authors, you know, get more honed for publication for their books. When I walk in the room, you can just feel that creative energy just kind of, you know, get your juices flowing. So I'm sure with all of that around you and doing that for 10 years, it doesn't surprise me you've written a book by any means. Because
well, of course.
How could you be inspired?
I feel very blessed. You know, I think every job, some days you want to be there and some days you don't. But whenever the latter happens, I remind myself, you know what, this is a pretty, or I did anyway when I was still there, it's a pretty wonderful place to just be for 8 hours a day. You know, I could be flipping burgers, and I've certainly done my share of, you know, construction and blue-collar work all through college. And I just feel very blessed not only to do something that I enjoy for a living, but, yes, to be surrounded by that creative synergy every day. And even at Disney, even just the artwork on the walls alone, it's visually stimulating. So, yes, I picked up a lot, I would say, of my storytelling sensibility and certainly my aesthetic and, you know, visual sensibility in animation, and all of that informs my writing.
Yeah. Now, what made you decide to write this particular, you know, YA novel, The Nameless Prince? I mean, was it something that has always kind of been in the back of your mind, or did something happen that just kind of sparked the idea?
Well, both. That's a very, very leading question. You know, I absolutely had plans to write, I called it Through the Rabbit Hole story. It's, you know, based on the hero's journey template, which I think a lot of people will know. But Through the Rabbit Hole is basically just, you know, like Alice in Wonderland, the protagonist meets usually a mythical creature and follows him or her through a portal to an alternate realm, and usually there learns the tools to come back and cope in everyday life. So, yes, I have, you know, a lot of favorites like That Bridge to Terabithia, of course, the Narnia Chronicles, Indian in the Cupboard. So I've just always had a love of that kind of template and had always had plans to write one. And but, of course, we never get to these things. They just sit on the back burner. But one day, yes, since you know the L.A. area, this might mean something to you. I was kind of just walking across the L.A. Wash one day and glanced down among the series of islands down there in the Wash, and one of them caught my attention, so I decided, you know, I had nothing going on that afternoon, so I just took a little walk among the islands and basically discovered a homeless camp, a very sophisticated homeless camp. And there, you know, decided, wow, it's got a water wheel churning, powering the dwelling. It's got tapestries strung from tree to tree the way I describe it in the book, and it was very fantastical. So I just thought, what if this homeless person was actually the gatekeeper to an alternate realm, and then looked over and saw a freeway overpass not too far away and decided that was the portal, and there.
Yeah, I know exactly the area. You know, those who don't know the LA area, I mean, and those who do, who've ever been through that section, I mean, I do know that area very, very well, and it is an interesting place when you're on foot walking around in there, so I can definitely see how that could.
Well, I have spent time down in the Wash just because I'm a painter, so a lot of us go down there and do plein air paintings in the Wash, so it's not unusual for me to be exploring those islands. But, yeah, it's a little bit of a seedy area. I've fictionalized it for the book and made it a little more grim than it actually is. But it's meant to be Glendale Avenue Bridge. I don't know if you know the Atwater, Silver Lake Atwater area.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it gets much worse a little further south. But
yeah.
It's certainly not pretty to look at. In fact, I ever watched Conan O'Brien's show?
What was that? You cut out toward the very end.
Conan O'Brien's show?
Yes, Conan O'Brien,
Yeah, when he was doing the Tonight Show for 5 minutes, he actually did a segment where he went out down. He brought his cast crew down and did a little travel series in the L.A. Wash. And, of course, it's all just graffiti, barbed wire, and it's pretty horrific to look at. So it's very funny.
It is, it is. But, you know, when you think about that, one of my favorite movies I love to watch is Stardust, which was originally a book, and I've never actually read the book, which is interesting because usually I read the book first and then, you know, see the movie.
Right.
But love that movie. If anybody hasn't seen it,
That was with Michelle Pfeiffer, correct?
Yes, with Michelle Pfeiffer. Yeah, yeah, the three witches. Of course, you know, she's a Wiccan. If nobody knows, she's a Wiccan. That's why she plays the role perfectly. And it has, not Dustin Hoffman. It has, I can't think of the other one from Meet the Fockers.
From Meet the Fockers. That's not.
Yeah, it was Dustin Hoffman, and then, but the dad, the father-in-law. Who's the father-in-law?
Oh, De Niro.
De Niro. De Niro. De Niro is in it. Is in Stardust. Yeah, great movie.
Right.
But the idea of the wall, and that's what you think when you're talking about, you know, how the L.A. Wash inspired, you know, kind of like the gateway to this other realm. It made me think of the wall in Stardust because there's kind of a seedy wall out, I guess, out in Europe somewhere.
That's right.
And that's where they got the idea for the wall, which is the same thing. It was a gateway into this other realm. So I love that because, you know, sometimes we can take something, you know, in our own reality, like you did, you know, with the L.A. Wash and just kind of, you know, how it looks and come up with this idea of having this gateway from our realm into another realm, and it, which helps us actually suspend our, you know, disbelief on going, oh, this can't be real. You know, we can actually suspend that for a second and go, well, maybe it's possible. You know, you never know. So I love that.
Right. Well, you asked about the inspiration. That was a big part of it, was the sort of contrast or the juxtaposition of this urban, gritty environment and then something like fantastical. So in Seth's reality, he needs an escape, as, you know, a lot of us do. And his mind, you know, it turns out the reader the entire time can decide, you know what, this is just a coping mechanism for him, and it was designed for his subconscious to reveal some much-needed truths that would set him free, but you can also believe that it's true. So anyway, I think they all kind of follow that template where something in the real world is, in fact, the portal. I don't remember The Wall. I remember really liking that movie and, you know, obviously drawing some comparisons with the Narnia Chronicles and just really loved the look of the movie. But from what I remember, The Wall it wasn't urban. And I think that's the uniqueness of this, is it's a very mundane urban environment. And I realized, you know, most of my work, whether it's my art paintings or my writing, it really is about the profound in the everyday, you know, just kind of exposing, it sounds corny, but exposing the fact that the miracles are around us every day if we choose to look for them.
Yeah, no, and I love that. Now, your main character, is this based off anybody, yourself, family, a friend, someone you've worked with, or just completely just this person just started talking to you and you're like, oh, I must write this person's story? Because, I mean, I know as authors, we do that. Your main character. I mean, I know with some authors, you know, you just have a character that just starts talking to you and you're just like, okay, I'll write your story. And then sometimes, you know, you just get inspired by somebody you know, be it family, a friend, a coworker, someone you absolutely don't like, I don't know. But, you know.
Right. Well, it's probably all of the above, I don't want to get too esoteric, but I do feel like everything we write is infused with life experience, whether we like it or not. You know, I think we like to be universal, and if we're masters of our craft, we can sort of make it something that resonates about the human condition. But, you know, it's almost impossible not to infuse your own experience into it. So I've heard it said that, you know, every character in a given piece can be seen as a different aspect of the author's psyche. So I absolutely believe every character in there is a voice, you know, that came out of me that expresses something about my worldview or my metaphysical values or what have you. But yeah, Seth is, without getting into too much trouble, 90% autobiographical. And a lot of the anecdotes, the opening scene in which Elena and Seth have to paint the wall because they were caught scribbling out somebody else's Seth plus Elena scrawlings on the wall, you know, that's all straight from my childhood.
I think we've all done a little graffiti in our childhood. I know I used to carve on the tables at school.
Well, the irony of it is, if you read the book, Seth and Elena, it's Seth's job to walk Elena home from school because she's a, you know, recently transplanted immigrant. So her parents and his parents decide he will be her guardian and walk her home, even though it's, you know, only three blocks. So everyone else decides, and again, this is autobiographical, that Seth and Elena are an item. So they are the ones that graffiti the wall with Seth plus Elena, and then Seth, for whatever reason, they quickly try to scribble them out, and of course, ironically, they are the ones that get busted and have to paint the wall.
Yeah, it's weird how that happens sometimes. You try and, you know, take care of something, and then you're the one who gets busted. But, you know, I love the fact that a lot of what's going on, you know, and exactly like you've been saying, is very true to life, where, you know, even if we haven't experienced it, we've known somebody who's probably encountered something very similar to these situations, and so we can relate. And I love that, because that is probably one of the biggest keys of storytelling, is somehow having it tie into where, you know, people can empathize or relate to, even see themselves in those characters and in situations that are happening in the story.
I think it has the ring of truth throughout, because, again, even if in the writing of a given scene, even if it wasn't directly plucked from life experience, every step of the way I was able to infuse it with something I had seen or experienced. I don't want to say too much, but, you know, there's a location called the Sanctum where Seth and Constantine have to navigate this canyon to get to a very sacred location. And, you know, I was lucky enough to have spent a month in Israel working for Animation Lab, and I drove 6 hours into the desert in Petra, to Petra in Jordan. And the Sikh, there's a four-mile canyon that leads you into this ancient civilization, and every little detail I was able to infuse was from that experience. But, you know, nobody needs to know that. I'm sharing it here. But I feel like there is a lot of resonance and a lot of truth being spoken simply because it was, you know, at some point infused with life experience. But with regard to Seth, since you asked, I just feel like it's an opportunity to say, yeah, he's meant to be, I kind of generalized the weird kid that I was, you know, the artist that sees things other people don't see and, you know, a little disenfranchised. I kind of generalized him into that archetype of just a little bit of a loner and a little bit sees the world differently. And I think a lot of adolescents will relate to that feeling of alienation and finding oneself, you know.
Right.
So I think that's the universal part, but also I really feel like it's a unique protagonist. Did you ever read Bridge to Terabithia by chance?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I remember as a kid, that really was the first book I picked up where I related 100% to the protagonist. I think Jesse was the name, and he was an artist, and he was sensitive and intellectual and cultured and all these things that his blue-collar environment was telling him were not okay for a boy. And I remember, God, it was the first time I felt like I was not alone on the planet. So I like the idea of offering that. Some people have asked me, why young adult? Why young adult? Well, I really just wanted to tell a good story, and I didn't think too much about conforming it to any genre or any readership or any marketing limitations. But I did think, you know what, I like the idea of providing not only a world that adolescents can escape into as a survival. Lord of the Rings got me through junior high, I'll be honest. But also providing a protagonist that perhaps some marginalized or disenfranchised groups of teenagers relate to.
Yeah, no, and I am a huge Lord of the Rings fan as well. Hobbit, I actually love The Hobbit more. I know a lot of people like,
so
oh, Hobbit. Yeah, everybody's like, oh, Hobbit's such a difficult read. I'm like, it's really not. But
no, it's actually much lighter than Lord of the Rings in terms of the language.
So.
Are you looking forward to the Peter Jackson film?
Yes, I am. I really, really am. I'm a huge fan. I own the first set of DVDs, of course, that came out for Lord of the Rings, and then when they did the extended director's copy, so all like the stuff they took out and all the commentary, I have that. Yeah, I'm a complete junkie. I admit it. I'm also a huge Harry Potter fan. I'm a complete junkie on that. But you know,
I'm old
funny.
School. I'm more C.S. Lewis, Narnia Chronicles, and Lord of the Rings. I grew up on that, and I have to give a shout out to my aunt Lorene, just because I just realized. She gave me her personal set of the Lord of the Rings way back in the mid-70s.
Wow.
I just spotted them on her shelf, and she was sweet enough to give them to me. But I think I reread them for all 3 years. We had unsustained, silent, unsustained, silent, something reading time. They called it USSR. And I had to read for 15 minutes every day, and I think I reread that trilogy for all 3 years of junior high until it actually fell apart. So thank you, Aunt Louie.
Yeah. We have C.S. Lewis at my house, too. We have the old ones from when I was a kid, and my kids have read them. You know, as you're talking about your the character Seth in your book, I started kind of cracking up because my son, and we talked a little bit about this before the show, because a lot of people on Facebook who follow me there, they see that there's a Seth Grenier, and he's which is my son on Facebook. That's the name he uses for his artist name.
A lot of coincidences there because you just told me his name was Dominic as well, right?
Yes, and his real name is actually Dominic. And
wow.
So I was kind of chuckling because I'm going, okay. I mean, the only difference is you have the K. He doesn't have the K at the end, but he is studying to be an artist. That's what he wants to do. He's more into the computer gaming aspect of it. So that's where he wants to do is the storytelling and the gaming world. But animation.
I just finished a gig at Disney Interactive working on the Pixie Hollow series. So I've had my brush with gaming. I did all the characters for Silent Hill 5 a while back.
Uh-huh.
And now I just did 5 months at Disney Interactive on a little iOS game, they call it, for the iPad. So, and then a lot of my students go into gaming. It's usually, you know, animated film or gaming.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
we have a lot of connections, your son and I.
Yes, we do. So, yeah, so I was just kind of chuckling because, you know, being from Southern California originally, which is where he was until he was 10, we now are in Southern Utah, which is definitely, it's more farming and relaxed, and people go
beautiful hiking. Beautiful state, though, huh?
It is very beautiful, but you know he's not. Let's go camping and hike and rappelling and ride the ATVs and I guess he doesn't mind going and shooting his paintball gun, but you know most of it he's not really into, and definitely the majority of the people here listen to country music, which is not his thing.
Well, we got to get him out of there.
get him to a good art school.
Are there any art schools in Utah?
I think there is up toward the Salt Lake Valley area, which is about 4 hours north of where I'm at. I have a feeling he'll probably end up either down in Vegas or he'll probably end up back in Southern California, like at your college where you teach, most likely. But
I would recommend it. It's a really served me very well.
It sounds like it. And I'm thinking, yeah, I may have to afterwards, maybe, you know, if you're up to it, you know, connect you guys and let him pick your brain a little bit if you're okay with that. Because
absolutely,
you know,
let's keep in touch, and he can come visit anytime if you're ever down here visiting by the school and, you know, audit, and you could sit in on my classes. I think it's great to have that, you know, because it's, you know, art can be viewed as so impractical, and you kind of don't know where to go. My mom was very smart. She would meet an artist living in the area and just put me on the phone with them, even as a, you know, 15-year-old kid, just so I could see examples of people that were making a livelihood, you know, out of their passion. And so she was very smart about that, but I think it only crystallized and it only solidified as a viable option when I visited the campus. And I actually met with, you know, a financial aid officer, and not that he needs to get that serious yet, but that's what crystallized it, and it made a solid plan out of it, and I immediately was able to get my general education out of the way before applying to Art Center. Anyway, it just makes it more concrete and realistic, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And, yeah, I mean, he's a junior this coming year in high school, so it's definitely, you know, a great thing. But when you were talking about your character Seth, though, it was kind of making me think about how he feels here because, especially this summer, a lot of his friends are gone. You know, they're doing the rodeo thing, and they're out camping, and, like I said, not really his big thing. I mean, he'll go when they go, like, to Lake Powell and do, like, you know, the skiing and jet ski thing, but... You know, typically, you know, he's been pretty much here. So he's been gaming, and at night he's been illustrating. And I'm like, well, why don't you go do this, or why don't you do that? And it was literally like when you're talking about your character, he does. He feels very isolated sometimes.
It is
a hard thing. And I think a lot, and you hit it right on the nail when you're talking about, you know, it's why you did YA, because a lot of teenagers, even – because when school year's going on, I mean, my son's in fencing. He's, you know, very active in school. He's in Spanish club. I mean, he's doing a lot of different stuff. But he still, as an adolescent, like everybody does, feels very, you know, sometimes isolated, and no one can understand him or relate to him. And I remember feeling like that, you know, I'm almost 40 now.
I don't think it's unique to artist types. I think, sadly, adolescence is a tough period for everybody, and everyone is just real, you know, who they are. So there's a lot of questioning that goes on, but I really feel for what you're saying. What I would say to that is, you know, I've actually done surveys. I almost did a documentary on, I don't want to say too much, but the topic was, what was it, artist, master, servant, something like that. And anyway, I heard the comment, there was kind of two archetypes for an artist. And one is somebody who gives back to society or tries to change the world through their craft. And the other was the complete opposite, this kind of lazy individual who leeches off society, do you know what I mean? And so I thought, what is that interesting chasm between the two perceptions? So I started just interviewing artists, and I was shocked at how many of them said, I give, I touch, I love through my artwork, that's my way of giving. So we're all aware that it's an expression of some kind. But anyway, I don't want to say too much, but most of the artists I've interviewed, sure, they developed their relationship with their craft or their muse because it was a safe place to go. It helped them make sense of the world, for one. But it, it when you feel isolated and you're not relating, it's a place to go that gives you a little bit of zen and a little peace and solace, and it's a safe place. But most of them at some point realize, yeah, you know what, I actually can have healthy relationships. I know how to connect with people, and now here I have this craft I've developed that I can't give up on or just abandon. So does that sound at all familiar?
Oh, it's very familiar.
Yeah, so I love the idea that we can actually, and you know, Phantom of the Opera is all about that. It's about
another movie I love and play.
What's that?
I said another one I love.
Well, I had heard about it my entire life, and I knew the chandelier was going to fall, and I knew it took place in the Paris Opera, and I knew certain things about it, but until I actually saw the movie version, I didn't realize that it was going to rock my world and, you know, that I would relate to it to the core. And that's what I'm getting at, is there's the earthly opportunity for connection, the earthly love, and then there's the muse that's constantly calling to her and actually taking her away from her earthly connections. So I think that's a struggle all artists experience. And in fact, sometimes if there's not a mate that understands this pull, it can be a threat to the maid. So I have a friend whose wife basically saw his relationship with his craft as a lover that she had to compete with. So anyway, I think it's tough to reconcile all of that. But all I wanted to say is I think it's a wonderful thing that children or adolescents can find a safe place to go and develop something very productive. There's a lot of worse things a kid could do than to draw or paint or write. But I think it's a little tricky reconciling it and then reaching out and learning to connect with people, but also sharing your work as two separate entities, you know?
Oh, yeah, totally. I hear you on that, and I completely agree, which is why I think, like I said, I haven't read your book, but, you know, just talking about your book and just, you know, who you are as a person, Dominic, and just kind of, you know, your passion and stuff, it sounds like it really resonates through your book, The Nameless Prince, in many ways as well, because, you know, readers, I think that's one reason why you have people who are very dedicated and love reading, because they don't know how to craft that naturally in their head, or they don't have, you know, like a writer or an illustrator or, you know, someone who's in the music profession or, you know, an actor or whatever, have those muses, you know, calling to them like you do in those, usually those kind of more artsy type fields. And so as a reader, I think it's a way for them to kind of, you know, so it's a way for us, I think, to extend our hand to those readers and draw them into our world and help them escape. Because I think everybody needs that type of escape and, you know, from their mundane lives. And, you know, even though
Go ahead. Well, I think that is one of the major themes of the book, is we're all just trying to find our purpose. I don't elevate artists or creatives above anybody else. I feel like we're all creative. It's part of the human experience. We all have a creative drive. It just looks different on different people. Whether it's an engineer or an inventor or a mathematician, I think we are supposed to engage our creativity, and a lot of people are dissatisfied when they can't find the avenue for that. So I do think it's absolutely universal, like you're saying, for those that can't articulate it or don't really have a vehicle for it. This kind of lets them know, you know what, you're not crazy. We're all kind of looking for that. So I do think it's proven to be universal so far.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. Are you planning on doing a sequel to your book, or is this going to be a standalone? Or
no, it's funny you would ask. I didn't intend it that way. It really was just an inspired concept, and I wanted to honor it and do it justice. But it's totally set up for that. So, ironically, I was working for Blue Sky in New York on Ice Age 5, which just came out. I spent a couple months in New York, and I had a long train commute. So just to be productive, I actually started playing around with, hey, a couple years later when Seth and Elena are in high school, what has become of, you know, Interia and their this whole experience that they kind of swept under the carpet? So I realized it is totally set up for a sequel. It's now three-quarters finished. And, yeah, my hope is that the readership will fall in love with the characters and want to follow them through adolescence. So, yeah, there is a sequel, and let's see how this one does.
Yeah,
of course. See if it becomes the next Harry Potter, and then we'll worry about the next one.
Well, you know, everybody's biting at the bit for the next Harry Potter book, so this could be it. You know, I mean, like I said, I love the classics, but when Harry Potter came out, I was like, because I am a total fantasy nut, and I was like, oh, yes, finally. And my husband thought I was crazy because I'd read the book in a day. No, I would. I'd get the book, and I would read it until like 4 a.m. in the morning so I could like finish the whole thing. And he's like, you know, you can put a bookmark in. I'm like, no, I have to know what's going to happen. So
you were not alone, apparently.
Yeah, so but I am looking forward to actually buying your book because I want to read it, and I think my son will enjoy it because, you know, he Lord of the Rings fan, Harry Potter fan, C.S. Lewis fan, so and one, you know, author's name, almost same as his, except different spelling. And then you got a character named Seth, which is the nickname he uses when he's, you know, out there doing his art, so, you know, win-win,
well,
right?
I hope you share it with him, and I would love to know what he thinks. You know, it's hard to get reviews from kids, so would love to know what he thinks. And for the record, it's not Harry Potter. It's very different, but I do think it has the same crossover appeal. I've spoken to adults who it absolutely resonates with them just on a different level due to their life experience. So to put it in really good company, I think my hope is that we're calling it fantasy for all ages. It's definitely not middle grade because the language is a little too sophisticated for middle grade. It's more young adult. But the protagonist is 10, which is atypical. But I personally think it's got appeal for all ages. And, again, to put it in a good company, I'm thinking The Alchemist. Did you ever read that?
Yes, I've read The Alchemist, too.
Yeah, it's kind of a simple archetypal template like that. And I think it resonates in its, hopefully, poetic simplicity and its little, you know, grains of wisdom that it drops throughout. So I think it's unique. It's not just sword and sorcerer. It's not just, you know, hardcore fantasy. It's actually more of like an archetypal approach and maybe got a little spiritual content in it.
Yeah. No, and that, I think those are really key elements, at least. And this is me, the editor and writer speaking, but you know, I know when I read books, especially, you know, since I've gone through my training and have learned, you know, the art of editing and writing books, that those I think are really the key points to have in it when you're telling a story, for them to actually, you know, like you said, to resonate and to really, you know, be a crossover and to appeal to a broad, you know, audience. So I think it's great that, you know, I don't know, I mean, do writers really intend to do that? I'm sure some do sit there and mathematically plan it out.
Well, I think everybody's different. Yeah, no, I think everyone's different, and I don't pass judgment on anyone. But for me, obviously universality is all storytelling.
Yeah.
Strives for that. So if you look at oral tradition around the campfire, all the way through mythology that informed religions the world over, through the latest Matrix film, really, what do they have in common? Well, something is usually learned or gained. Sure, you have tragedies that become cautionary tales, but otherwise something is imparted, whether it's just how to build a fire or, you know, how to cope with a certain aspect of the human condition. Something is conveyed that, you know, you could call it enlightenment or catharsis. But anyway, I think, of course, universality is the goal. But for me, you know, I read a screenwriter did an interview in which he said, I don't worry about the thematic content. I don't worry about meaning. I just write about the bank heist, and I just explode the helicopter. And he just kind of focused on the superficial plot. And I really thought, you know, A, he's just being humble, because I don't believe it for a minute. But I also believe the joke's on him, because the very act of putting pen to paper infuses it with meaning, whether it's just the projection of the reader or the, you know, audience member on the other side of the screen. It's going to happen. People are going to read meaning into it because it's human nature. So anyway, for me, it's almost like the question of the cart horse. It doesn't, inspiration for me is, what am I saying? And like I said, mm-hmm. I think most of my work is about illuminating the metaphysical all around us every day and, you know, just kind of illustrating there's something a little more going on here than the empirical mind would often like to acknowledge. So for me, anyway, it starts with a parable. The Nameless Prince is all really just one big parable, and it's all symbolism, so everything else comes out of that. So I'm sure everybody works differently, but I would never construct a superficial plot and go from A to B if it wasn't saying something.
Right, right. No, makes sense. Now, we have a couple of questions in the chat room. One of our guests that's listening in today was kind of wondering about your publisher, who your publisher is, and how you found your publisher. So can you share a little bit about that?
Sure, of course. Yeah, it's Twilight Times. It's, of course, available through Barnes & Noble and through Amazon and all the normal avenues. But the publisher is a small press called Twilight Times. Lyda Quillen is the publisher that I've been working with. She's amazing. And basically, I did what everybody else does. I've done the pounding the pavement route. I looked for representation. I don't want to say too much, but very early on when I was promoting this, I sent it to Penguin, and I got a very, very encouraging letter, not a form letter. It was, you know, personally addressed to me saying, you know, it's unsolicited, so we cannot consider it, but I fully believe this will land somewhere, and I highly, highly encourage the presentation. So I believed it. You know, I have no reason to lie to me. So I believed in its potential, and I pounded the pavement like everyone else, did the agent search, still have not landed an agent. But in all of that, decided I'm not going to wait. I could be old and gray if I wait for someone to validate me and love me.
Yeah.
So I started coming out on my own. And, you know, I could have held out for a major, but when I got the offer from Twilight Times, I just realized, you know, I'm not going to wait. So it's hopefully going to do very well, despite the fact that it's a small press. And I actually heard about Twilight Times through a blog post, you know, in the fantasy arena.
Uh-huh.
So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it totally did. And I haven't read too many of their books, but I have seen them, and they are when I, you know, have people who contact me for freelance editing, you know, to look at the content to kind of get back, you know, on with them about, you know, are my characters strong enough? Am I introducing this character soon enough, or do I, you know, or too soon? You know, all that stuff that we look at as authors and as editors to make sure everything's flowing right and, you know, happening the way it should be happening. They are on my list as one of the small press publishers to check out. I haven't done too much with them personally.
What I would say is, and I'm new to all of this, so I'm no expert, but what I would say is they're very author-friendly. I've gotten that. Very author-friendly, even in terms of the percentages and all of that. But also, we're all kind of just working together toward the same goal. So there's a real nice community of writers that are published through Twilight Times that band it together, and it's a nice balance of the print version and the ebook, and for sure exploiting a web presence and going that route, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense to me, because sometimes the big publishers, and I do know a few authors who are with, you know, bigger publishers like Penguin and Random House and Scholastic and, you know, some of those guys, and actually, my fiction editor for Stories for Children magazine has a picture book getting published with HarperCollins. And just talking to her, you know, and this is just a recent thing with her, and it's just a picture book. It's not even a novel. I mean, and not saying that picture books aren't as important as novels are, but, you know, picture books are smaller. It's a different market. It's definitely more of a niche. And she's already going nuts, and I'm like, that's just a picture book. I can't even imagine, like, novel-wise, when you're with bigger guys, you know, you don't get as much of the hands-on, you know, holding as I think you probably do with a small press. At least it sounds like it with yours anyways. So with that in mind, what have you been doing marketing-wise? I mean, I know you've been doing some interviews and guest posts, you know, on Facebook, on some people's blogs. You know, you're doing this show. What are the things you have going on, you know, within the social network marketing and just, you know, event marketing that authors can do to get the word out there about their books?
again, I'm navigating all of this for the first time, so I don't know that I'm an expert in anything, and I think that's the beauty of Twilight Times is I'm constantly being provided with resources and links and opportunities, so I'm learning. But, you know, for me, so far, again, and you talk about your friend being overwhelmed with HarperCollins, it's all I can do. I'm actually working two jobs. I'm teaching at Art Center, which I've done for 14 years, and then on top of that, I was doing the Disney Interactive gig, which is ended Friday. But so I'm doing all my publicity on top of that. So it's all I can do to just keep up with the leads that were provided by the publicist. Twilight Times brings on a publicist and provides me with leads. So, yeah, so far it's been exactly what you described, guest posts, blog interviews, spotlights, they call them, on just different blogs. It's been podcasts like this one and radio interviews. I've reached out with them, you know, I'm trying to go locally, and I had a wonderful article about me for Burbank and Beyond, which is a little, you know, small circulation paper here in Burbank. I'm working with Burbank Public Libraries event. And to bring in actors rather than just doing a dry author reading, you know, do something more fun, bring in some actors, book signings, Skylight Book here on Vermont at Silver Lake. I'm going to do an event there. So to answer your question, I'm really focusing on the web presence. You mentioned social networking. Of course, the Facebook page is really growing in its visibility. LinkedIn. I have a website, namelessprints.com, no the, but just namelessprints.com. I've got YouTube author interviews and YouTube title treatments that direct you to the website. So I'm coming at it from all angles, but I really am focusing on the web presence.
Yeah, no, it is so much to try and take in and do, and especially when you have a full-time job that you do, and in your case, you have a full-time job, plus you have the studio jobs that come in as well that, you know, sometimes could be years, just a few months, depending on, you know, how long the projects are. And I can't even imagine trying to add – I mean, I'm pretty busy anyways, but I can imagine being from your area and like I said, you know, working and being around, you know, all the different, you know, creative types in the Studio City area. And I was just there as a buyer, and, you know, I mean, sometimes we would, you know, show up for sets or photo shoots because, you know, we would bring stuff in. Like I remember Austin Powers when they had their little Fembots, the outfits they wore all from Fredericks, and I remember being a part of that and getting all that costuming together for them. And, I mean, it was, like, so minute to the craziness that goes on, and I just remember standing back going, and I thought my job was nuts as a buyer, you know, so I can't even imagine being a debut author, you know, with a novel, trying to get that done, plus teaching, plus, yes.
it's not really on much of a lot outside of this, but it feels good. It's really fun to talk about the work after putting so much into it. It's really fun to see it landing with people, and I've gotten some really sweet reviews, so it's actually the fun part. I'm taking 2 weeks off starting, you know, today, Monday. I've got weeks devoted to promoting. So I don't know if any of this helps, but there is no one way to go at it, and that's what I'm learning. It's all new territory, just like distribution in film has opened up to the kid in his garage with Final Cut Pro. The publishing world has opened up, and there's no monopoly anymore. So I think we're all navigating a new territory, and I'm just finding the web presence is growing and growing. I just Google Nameless Prince Domingo, and it's everywhere. One just crosses his fingers and hopes that all translates into sales.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll see.
It's true. I mean, and you definitely understand the concept of just because you do a bunch of marketing and stuff doesn't mean that sales, I mean, especially, you know, with the film industry, I mean, the money and the billions of dollars they stick into stuff, sometimes the movie flops, so...
It's kind of fun. I've taken out sponsored ads on Facebook and to draw attention to the Facebook page. And, of course, the whole function of the Facebook page is really to drive traffic to the website so they can learn more about the book and then, of course, hopefully order it. But one doesn't know if 500 likes in a week translate into sales. Only time will tell on that. But I really want to say, from my perspective, of course, the publisher wants it to do well. And from my perspective, when I signed with Twilight, I really thought, you know, I would be content to just share this with friends and family. That's my goal, is to just share my message. And it feels really good to be able to wrap it up and give it as a gift to a loved one. But that part of me does believe in its potential to do Harry Potter stuff. Sure, I would love to retire as a writer, and that's my goal. And every little step, I think, puts me more in a position to be able to do that. But it's not a monetary concern. It's really, I just want to share. That's why I'm on the planet. I am here to share my message. So I want to go wide just so that it can make a little difference and give me a sense of purpose. It's not going to give me the house on a hill or anything like that.
Yeah, and, you know, and I totally understand and relate to that, because a lot of people ask me that same question, you know, like, oh, you do, because I have this magazine, Stories for Children magazine, that everybody who works on the backside of it, including myself, none of us are compensated at all. I mean, it's just total volunteer work. But we enjoy, and we used to do it monthly, and then it got a little crazy with everything else that I do, so now we're every other month, but you know, I do it. I don't do it because I want to make money. And I actually take the money that I make as a freelance writer and editor and actually pay now my contributors, not a lot, but a little bit of money to say thank you, you know, for contributing to the magazine.
Wow.
And I don't mind doing that.
I commend you, really. That's the one thing I've learned, is a lot of these blog reviewers and blog hosts are really doing it just for a love of the craft. And I commend you. That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I do it. You know, I mean, eventually, yeah, I'm going to have to, you know, probably do less or not do any of this anymore so I can focus more on my books. I just had a picture book that was published back in 2009 that won the Mom's Choice Award. Silver. Thank you. And it was an exciting experience. I realized, okay, I eventually get back to my own personal writing. But, you know, even with my own personal writing, when I do my short stories, my articles, when I wrote my picture book, I was very much, you know, I'm very much like you. I do it because I love doing it. I just want to share with people. And, you know, if money comes, great. If it doesn't, you know, okay, you know, but my message is getting out there, and it's kind of like, maybe you feel this way too. Do you feel like you're basically leaving a legacy for your friends and your family? So when you're gone, you know, they can look back and say, wow, you know, look at who you've touched. Look at what you've done. Look at what you've accomplished.
Of course.
You know, cause
the older I get, the more the posterity matters.
Yes.
The more I sense my own mortality, the more leaving a legacy becomes important to me. Money so far has, even in my filmmaking, because I did make my own live-action films, really the money comes into the equation only in that it will allow me to go on to the next step. It will allow me to continue producing my work.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Now, because we have a lot of people who listen to the Stories for Children show. You know, we have people who listen who want to learn more about the authors and, you know, what inspires them, you know, who they really are as people, because, you know, it seems as we become more technology, you know, more of a technology era and you know, race, that, you know, it's not just about the book anymore. People, you know, want to know more about the, you know, who's behind it. But the other thing, too, is we have, you know, people who listen that aren't, you know, who've thought about writing or are beginning their steps of writing or, you know, have been writing for a while and are starting to feel discouraged. So do you have any, you know, sayings, quotes, have you had any mentors that have actually reached out and have shared some advice with you that's helped keep you going, that you can share with our listeners that might inspire them and make them, you know, realize that even though it can be a tough industry to be in, that there is that silver lining out there. It takes a while.
Yeah. Well, I think examples are very encouraging. And I surround myself with people who have taken great risks for their passion constantly. So being surrounded, if you can find those people and create a network, you know, it doesn't have to be a formal writer's group, but just anyone who's really living the life and pounding the pavement. And I stopped using the word sacrifice. I'm saying invested in their passion. I think that's what you need. So, and examples of successful people. So I think my career is an example, if nothing else, of diversity. I've been able to do a number of different things and shift gears, and, you know, it's evolved. So I think that is inspiring and encouraging to people, and that's what I would look for. Beyond that, I think just more than anything, it's persistence and perseverance. And that is called faith. I have one of the major themes in The Nameless Prince is the power of faith. What does that mean? It doesn't just mean blindly believing that there's some, you know, crown waiting for you in heaven. It means believing that even the pitfalls happen for a reason and that there's something to be learned from it. Does that make sense, that even the setbacks are of some kind of value?
Yes.
So there's a lot of lip service about, oh, hold on to all those rejection letters because they're your badge of pride. I don't know about that, but I feel like if you can just shift your point of view and realize that everything is, even doors closing, are meant to be signals that kind of steer you in a slightly different direction, that's what I mean by faith. So I think that I have unknowingly taken risks and that I am an example of just not giving up. But for me, that's just naive, childlike faith, I guess.
It's not. I'm that way too. Oh yeah, it makes total sense. I am like that too. And a couple, Marsha Casper Cook, who's actually my partner at the World of Ink Network, she's in our chat room, and we have a few other different shows that we do here that are very diverse and different. And the hosts are throwing out, like one of them is actually JD is not on, JD Holiday, but they have a show on Saturday. So if you get a chance, you know, definitely check it out. But it's called Storytime Gather Round. And basically they invite an author to come on and read an excerpt from their book. You know, if it's a picture book, obviously usually they read most of the picture book. But like in your case, it'd be like, you know, a few pages randomly from the book. And so they're saying, oh, you know, what do you think about coming on here? And Marsha, you know, has been very inspired by what you're saying and said that you'd be a great guest on one of our other shows and even on Fran's show book discussion. So I'll definitely have to send you emails on that because everybody's been enjoying what you've been saying. So you,
oh, wow.
So you're not alone in thinking that. A lot of us do think that. But it is true. And, you know, the way the industry is and sometimes it does feel like lip service, but you're right. You know, it is stirring us in directions we need to be. Marsha and I say that a lot on our show, What is Success, all the time. So I love the fact that you're saying that too, because, you know, when people hear it from the same people constantly, they're like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And then when they hear it from other people, like, oh, okay, maybe they're not.
Oh, yeah, you're not crazy, and it validates anyway. And I don't know how much time we have left, but I do feel like that was a little abstract, and so I could a little slightly more practical advice to those writers that are aspiring and more practical, you know, wanting to study. I think you need to find a balance of listening to feedback and taking it in and learning from it, but sometimes just holding up your middle finger and going, you know what, there's always going to be doubters out there. There's always going to be someone to tell you no. So you've got to stick to your guns and, you know what I mean, not be discouraged by negative feedback. Because, of course, competitiveness, there's all kinds of professional jealousy. There's a lot of people that will tell you no. So that's slightly more practical advice, is get your middle finger warmed up. But also, in terms of the process, I'm trying to stick to what I know. So I'm new to this, I'm not an expert, but I do know the creative process. So a lot of people get discouraged when it does not feel inspired or cathartic, their process. So I feel like, if nothing else, I've had to make creativity regularly for my entire adult life because I treat it like a job. So the best advice I can give is really to know different models of the creative process. And, you know, it has to do with identifying the problem and then brainstorming or thumbnailing it and then germinating on it and then the burst of inspiration and then the execution phase. All those stages, the more you understand them, the more the fear dissolves. So kind of like writer's block or the empty canvas syndrome, that can be daunting. Or let's say you really love getting that initial inspiration down on paper, but you don't love fleshing out each scene, and that seems a little more mechanical to you. Well, you just have to get to know the creative process and understand the, we call it the hot and the cold, the more intuitive and then the more intellectual. Sometimes the execution phase is dry, and it seems to lack inspiration, but if you understand the value of it, you can actually get into how meditative it is to just finesse and execute something. So anyway, just know the creative process, and I think that takes a lot of the blocks out of your path because the fear goes away.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it makes
people
a lot of sense.
And a lot of people that don't understand the creative process also might sabotage themselves and never finish something. I know a lot of people that the fear of sharing the work, the fear of putting it out there and possibly receiving rejection and ever completing something. So I know a lot of people that plan and plan, research and sit on it, and 7 years go by and they haven't produced anything. And then other people dive in blindly without doing the or foundation. So somewhere in the middle is plugging along with perseverance.
Yeah, no, and that's very true. And I've met people on all those levels as well. And, you know, it makes a difference on being in that middle ground for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would love, because we are getting towards the end of our show, but do you have any, like, silly or crazy stories when you've been working on the book, The Nameless Prince, that you'd like to share with us that, you know, usually there's one or two that an author has as they're working on their project.
I have a zinger. Yeah, I have a little zinger, and it's not that sensational. It's not like a groupie throwing laundry at me at a book signing or anything like that. But it's esoteric, like most of the things I've said today, but it is kind of trippy. So as you know, it was inspired by seeing the violence in the wash, and I wasn't picking something local. If I ever wanted to do research, all I had to do was take a walk 5 minutes from home. So there was a point in the writing of the climax where the flood takes over the entire canal and kind of wreaks havoc on the islands. And Seth later goes back and sees the damage that's been done.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it had just rained in my area. I walked down and see exactly what it did to all the bamboo and the sunflowers and all the other flora and fauna of the Wash. So I just took a walk as a research mission, and mm-hmm. I saw something that stopped me in my tracks. And basically what it was, in the writing of the novel, there's a key image. Seth sees a mural on the wall of the LA Wash of a woman, a goddess, with a tear suspended in the corner of her eye. So I knew when it came up in the writing, I didn't want to analyze it, but I knew it meant something, and I just kept bringing it back without analyzing it and bringing it back, and it became a central image in the novel. So in the sketchbook, Seth draws the picture of his birth mother, even though he's never seen her, the only photograph he's ever seen. He does a very faithful portrait with the tear suspended in the corner of her eye. But he doesn't realize he's glimpsed it in the wash. It just comes out in his drawing. So anyway, it had a presence in the novel, and I didn't know why. It turned out to be the central image that kind of triggered the very thing that would free him in the end. So without saying too much, it became a very important image. Like I said, only months later when writing the climax scene did I walk down into the wash and see that actual image on the concrete of that woman with the tear in the corner of her eye. Emerged in the writing, and later I saw that it actually existed in the wash.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and things happen, like, believe it or not, it sounds a little kooky, but little synchronistic things like that happen throughout the writing of it, and that's why I believe in it so much. It just felt like it was meant to be. And so, you know, you could say, I must have subconsciously glimpsed while driving over the bridge, and it was somewhere in my memory banks. Entirely possible, but I still think it's pretty fascinating how these things come together.
Oh, I agree, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, you know, exactly that. Someone would probably go, well, he probably subconsciously picked it up and didn't, you know, take it in exactly. But, you know, it's true. Things like that do happen. I mean, I have literally written – oh, gosh, I can actually share one. I wrote a short story about that involved my sister, who's right beneath me in age, and we're 15 years apart, and I kept dreaming about it, and it kept bugging me. So I finally wrote the story about it, because I was like, oh, you know, I'll write the story about it, you know, get this dream out of my head. And it was about her getting in a car accident when she first started driving.
Mm-hmm.
And it really bothered me. And I kid you not, I mean, not as severe as what happened in my dream or in the short story that I put this dream in by any means, because she, of course, walked away. But she hit black ice and literally went off the road. Now, her car was totaled, but she was completely fine. But, I mean, It was really weird. I was sort of going, okay, I don't want to, be predicting the future here. And I didn't know, like, 10 years. Yeah, it was like 10 years before she even, like, was driving that I had this dream, and it was, like, crazy. So, I mean, stuff like that does happen, and I think that's, you know, it's kind of cool when you hear that, because it's like, wow, you know, that here's this image, and you put it in your book, and then, wow, you know, you go down there, and there it is, you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to assign too much importance to artists, but there's a book called Meaning and Truth in the Arts, and it's really all about, if you go through 500 years of art history, how quantum physics and a number of discoveries that have been made in the scientific realm were being spoken about, you know, previous by artists. Mm-hmm. We do have some kind of weird access, I think, to the metaphysical truth. But, you know, also, simply put, they say time doesn't really exist. It's just a construct we humans have come up with, that linear time doesn't exist. So, of course, we have access to the past and the future, you know? It just comes maybe in glimpses.
Yeah,
now I've said it. Now they think I'm crazy.
They don't think you're crazy.
Okay.
And if they think you're crazy, that's okay. That means we're all crazy, which means technically the crazy people are the ones calling us crazy. That's what my husband tells me. That's what he tells me all the time. He's like, only crazy people say that. So.
Right.
Well,
I like your policy.
Yes, I would love for you, Dominic, to share again your website and where people can learn more about you, your book, The Nameless Prince. You know, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'll definitely email you a little later today with some more information and get you in contact with some of our other hosts to see if we can get you on some of their shows.
Awesome.
It's been a real pleasure, and I'll definitely have to. I do get down to the LA area. I still have family down there, so when I do, I'll have to definitely connect with you because it would be fun.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so the people can learn more about the book by just going to the official site, which is www.namelessprince.com. No, just namelessprince.com. I would say go there. There's a lot of great artwork. There's actually a graphic novel that was meant to be timed with the release of the novel, but we're just now finishing it up, the prototype. We're going to shop it around at CTN, which is Creative Talent Network Animation Expo. And hopefully land with, you know, Dark Horse or one of the other indies. But anyway, there's a lot of stunning artwork from the upcoming graphic novel. And again, that's at namelessprince.com. Of course, there are links to order the book that take you to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or even Twilight Times. And those three venues, you can just do a search for the book and access it that way as well. Beyond that, you know, my illustration is just DominicDomingo.com, and that's CK on the Dominic. And then, you know, IMDb, that's how I do a lot of my networking. I guess I would really love if your viewers went and liked the Facebook page. So I don't know the URL off the top of my head, but if on Facebook you just search Nameless Prince, we have a page. So I would say go there.
Okay. Well,
I think we covered the bases.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure, like I said, to have you on the show, Dominic. It's fun actually talking to a different Dominic than my son, too. I don't get that opportunity very often.
For sure.
It's not an overly common name, so
it's been
fun saying the name without like yelling it at the teenager.
Right. How many kids do you have?
I have three.
Without yelling the three names and then settling on the Dominic.
Yeah.
My mom would run through the list, Tina, hey, Tony, Nick, before she'd get to the right name.
Yeah, well, he's at the beginning of the list. He's the oldest, so.
Okay.
And he always gets the full name, his whole first, middle, and last name.
Right. I've also noticed there are fewer Dominics on the West Coast in New York than in Chicago. I run into a lot more Dominics. So.
Yeah. Well, there's more Italians over there. That's probably why.
There you go. Exactly.
Well, it's been a pleasure, like I said, and I wish you much success with the book. It sounds like a fun book. It, you know, you definitely like a lot of the different, you know, authors that I've liked growing up as well. So I'm definitely looking forward to when my copy comes and reading it, and then of course passing it off to my son. And I'll probably read it with my 7-year-old. I mean, obviously even though she's 7, she, believe it or not, she loved the movie Avatar by James Cameron. So and she likes Lord of the Rings when I read it to her.
I have to say, tread lightly, though, because there are some dark elements and
a
couple words that you might have to explain.
Yeah, the
message is very positive and the message is wonderful, but you know, conservative people might react to a couple words.
Yeah, but like I said, she likes Avatar by James Cameron, which we're like, really? It's like one of her favorite movies. So
that's pretty sophisticated stuff.
It is, especially for a 7-year-old. So when I was kind of talking to my son about you coming on the show and your book and stuff, she's like, well, I want to read the book. So I was like, okay, we'll start reading it and we'll see how you do. So we'll see.
Well, I'm honored. Tell me what you think when you finish. I'm very interested.
I will. We wish you much success and a and hopefully relaxing week, even with the marketing going on, at least for the next 2 weeks. Hopefully you'll get some, you know, downtime too.
It's a while, yeah.
But you're, I'm sure you need
it.
Yeah,
no, I think I breathed for the first time on Saturday after finishing up at midnight on Friday. So there's a little of that as well, recuperation time.
All right. Well, you take care, and we will talk to you later. And
thank you so much.
You're welcome. And so our listeners know, we do have a couple of shows planned. We are still getting them into our system. Wednesday, there is a Family Matters show with myself and Irene Roth and Keisha Burcham. We will actually be turning the tables on Irene Roth. She has a couple of books coming out, so we're going to be talking to her about those books. And they actually are on a lot of the topics we cover on the Family Matters show, about, you know, how to empower kids and family and all of that. So we definitely invite you to listen to that show. That is at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 Central, 4 Mountain, and 3 Pacific. And then Marsha Casper Cook next week has a romance show at 12 noon. I don't have the date. I'm assuming it's Tuesday, since that's when she does A Good Story is a Good Story. She has Cassandra Daines, Bellany Hill. It'll be with Rebel Ink Press. So definitely tune into that show. Her romance writer shows are always entertaining and fun to listen to. And then Fran Lewis will also be back on in August with Focus on Discussion. I'm sorry, Book Discussion. Why I say Focus on Discussion? It's Book Discussion with Fran Lewis. So definitely look out for that show in August. We will be getting those shows up. You can always find out more about us at theworldofinknetwork.com or at our blog, worldofinknetwork.blogspot.com. And, of course, you can always put in to Facebook, World of Ink Network, and find our fan page there and follow our shows because we always post our links there as well. And we thank you all for listening to our show today. Our guest was Dominic Domingo. His book is The Nameless Prince. You can find it at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and other booksellers across the country. And the publisher is Twilight Press. And we thank you again. Have a great day and rest of the week. Bye-bye.
Follow me to the world of ink.